Welcome to Animals Today, your home for serious talk about animals. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Well, after years to get ready for implementation of the ban on foie gras in California, the liver lovers are fighting back. California once again has taken a leading step in animal welfare and in 2004 passed a law banning the sale or production of this French atrocity. As you probably know, geese or ducks are force-fed to create a fatty liver, which unbelievably is enjoyed by diners around the world. Then Governor Schwarzenegger signed the ban into law, but postponed its implementation till this month. Well, that time has come, and as of July 1, California is now the only state with such a law. But there's now a legal challenge being waged, and a coalition of producers and Hots restaurant group has filed suit and asked a judge for an injunction. They're claiming the law is vague and that it violates the U.S. Constitution Commerce Clause. So, what do you think about this ban? Is this a good first step? Does it achieve anything really important in the welfare of animals or for the state of California? Well, we're going to pose these questions to today's special guest, Professor Gary Francione. Gary is Distinguished Professor of Law at Rutgers University School of Law. His very active website, where you can read his blogs and essays, is www.abolitionistapproach.com. Listen, be sure to visit the site. It's outstanding. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Peter, for having me.
Okay, so what about this foie gras? Now, Gary, you and I have spoken before about similar issues, and I'm going to guess that you don't think much of the foie gras ban in California or any legal arguments about it, right?
Yes, Lori, that accurately describes my position. You know, it's interesting. In 2004, when this thing was passed, I made the statement that I thought it was a bad idea for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which is it gave people the idea that this meat product was different from other animal products. And as you said in the lead-in to the segment, you know, you talked about how this is a really disgusting thing that people, you know, remarkably like to eat in different places. And the bottom line is, I would say the same thing about steak. I would say the same thing about milk. I would say the same thing about eggs. I mean, it's like, you know, these are all really things that we have no business eating. And, you know, it's a cultural matter that most of us don't eat it because it's an expensive product. And culturally, we don't, you know, it's not a popular thing here. But I mean, really, when you think about it, you know, goose liver, whether it's fattened goose liver or not, is every bit as, you know, there's no more disgusting than, say, a hot dog, and, you know, which everybody thinks is fine and probably consumed by the trillions this week, cause it's July 4th. So, you know, but anyway, when this law was passed, and I said it would never, you know, it would never come into effect, that when, you know, on the eve of its coming into effect, there would be legal challenges to it. I believe, I don't remember because I can't find the things that I wrote on it now, but I believe I actually said that I thought that there would be challenges based on the vagueness of the prohibition. And sure enough, you know, this lawsuit was filed, and I laughed when I saw this thing because it's really quite remarkable. This is exactly what I said was going to happen. You know, there would be, you know, I mean, we had this big campaign in 2004, and, you know, the groups that were behind it, oh, this is a great victory, and I said, no, it wasn't a great victory, and I got all this hate mail. You should have seen some of these emails I got. People were furious with me because I was critical of this so-called ban, and you know, and I got a lot of really nasty emails from animal people all over the place that I should have been, you know, that I should support this, that this is a great idea, that this was the first step, blah,
right,
blah, 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 blah. It's not, you know, and I mean, right. I don't know whether it will go into effect, but you know what, Laura, the bottom line is, it doesn't matter whether it goes into effect or whether it doesn't go into effect. It's worthless. All it does is make people who are eating their hot dogs feel better about eating their hot dogs because they don't eat goose liver. So what?
Okay, now, in your book, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation,
right,
co-authored with Robert Gardner, you reject the concept of regulation of animal exploitation. Is that how you see the ban on foie gras?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, yes, I do talk about regulation in the book with Gardner. But what I was talking about there is just basically welfare reform, larger cages, you know, better ways of slaughtering them, or supposedly better ways of slaughtering, things like that. I mean, this is more. I mean, the goose liver legislation in California is arguably more like sort of wait a second. It purports to be a ban that you know that this product is going to be taken out entirely from the range of choices available to people, at least in California. And so, in that sense, it's a little bit. It's not the standard welfare reform. But what I also talked about in the book with Garner was the idea that these single issue campaigns. This is a perfect, and I mean, it is an absolutely perfect example of a single issue campaign. It's like the anti-fur campaign. It's like the anti-fur campaign, which makes everybody think leather and wool and silk are fine. This campaign, which makes everybody think that every other animal product in the world is fine. These things really remember something. We live in a world in which exploiting animals is the default position. So, exploiting animals is considered to be an okay, natural, moral, right thing to do. So when you pick out something like this, you suggest, and the message that gets conveyed to the public is that this is somehow worse than everything else, and it's different from everything else, and that if we remove this, then it will, the moral landscape looks better, looks brighter. And the answer is no, that's nonsense. This is no worse or no better than anything else.
I see your point, but isn't there value in educating the general public, let's say, about this animal issue as an entry point to the entire field of animal rights? I mean, isn't it possible that this particular practice of force-feeding ducks and geese to make food will strike a chord in some people who may not have thought about much about the welfare and rights of non-human animals before?
No, I actually don't. I think that so few people consume that product. So few people the number of people who eat foie gras is infinitesimally small, and the people who don't eat it aren't going to stop eating hot dogs or hamburgers because of this campaign. They might stop eating hot dogs and hamburgers if you have a different sort of campaign that says, you know, what's the difference between your dog and the cow and the pig and the chicken? Or if you think what Michael Vick did was wrong, why are you consuming animal products? I mean, you might get them if you get them to, you know, really what we need to do is we need to sort of shift the paradigm, both as a social matter and within the lives of individual people. You don't shift the paradigm by saying, hey, there's something that you don't eat anyway that's really horrible. And the person says, yeah, that really is horrible. And boy, I'm glad I don't eat it. I'm a good person. Here, pass me that hot dog. I understand why it's appealing to people, but look, Lori, I've been doing this for 30 years now, and for 30 years I've been having people in the animal welfare movement tell me, it's a good first step, and if we only do this, we'll get to a good place later on. And the bottom line is, we're exploiting more animals now in more horrific ways than ever before in human history, including 30 years ago. So, it's not getting any better. So maybe we really sort of need to rethink the strategy. On the other hand, I also understand that these animal groups need these single issue campaigns to sell. This is how they do their fundraising. So I understand that.
Right.
I understand that, but yes, that's how they do business. I understand that, but that's a separate question from whether or not it's effective.
Right. And Gary, now you've written about the moral schizophrenia about animals. So do you believe the way we think about animals is flawed, immoral, or somehow defective?
I think it's actually delusional in the same way that, I use that expression, moral schizophrenia, quite deliberately. Clinical schizophrenia is a delusionary way of thinking, and I think that in many ways, a delusional way of thinking, and I think that with respect to animals, we engage in delusional thinking, and I mean that really quite literally. I mean, look, if you could take a step back, I mean, it's hard for us to take a step back because we're steeped in it. It's our culture. It's what we were all raised with. But, if you came down from another planet and, you encountered a group of people who, loved their dogs and loved their cats and their birds or whatever non-human companions they had and regarded them as members of their family, but then stuck forks into animals that were indistinguishable from the animals who were members of their family, you would say, boy, this is a weird group of people. This is a strange group of people who don't really think very clearly. And I think that that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that it's a form of moral schizophrenia. I mean, on one hand, we say, yeah, animals matter, and animals matter morally. On the other hand, if they matter morally, whatever else you can do or can't do with them, you can't eat them. particularly when you have no good reason to do so. The best justification we have for inflicting pain, suffering, and death on 56 billion animals a year, and that doesn't count fish. And so if you take another, you know, it's probably at least that number. So you're talking over 100 billion animals a year. And the best excuse, the best justification we have for that is that they taste good. And then we have the audacity to criticize Michael Vick because he kills dogs and he enjoys watching dogs fight. And, you know, the rest of us are like, you know, sitting around, you know, he sits around a pit watching dogs fight and he enjoys it. He used to until they put him in jail for it. But, you know, he did that and he enjoyed it. And we sit around the summer barbecue pit roasting the corpses of animals that are treated every bit as badly as those animals that he fought.
Okay, don't go away. We're speaking to Professor Gary Francione. You're listening to Animals Today. Welcome back to the show. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. This is Animals Today. We're speaking to Professor Gary Francione. Gary, recently we have discussed vivisection on the show, so I want to permit you to share your views. First, from a scientific perspective, would you acknowledge that we humans have benefited from research on non-human animals? And I will give an example of the development of the heart-lung bypass machine, which has been used to save the lives of so many people. It was developed by using dogs as subjects.
Well, Lori, I mean, it's hard to make attributions of causation to discoveries that are, you know, involving the use of animals. And the reason is because we don't really have any control. I mean, you use animals for everything. And it's like if I every time I take an examination, I use a particular pen, and I get an A on exams all the time. Well, then I'm going to come away thinking, you know, this is my special pen, and we're not really going to know what the role of my pen is until I take an exam without it. Since we use animals for every conceivable procedure and product that we develop, to say that, well, haven't we gotten benefits from animal use, and then to point to particular instances, the answer is, look, we use animals for everything. So if we took them out of the equation, we don't really know what we would know or what we wouldn't know. But, I mean, look, I'm willing to argue, to say for argument's sake, let's assume we have, because, you know, we could go round and round about whether we've actually gotten benefits. And I actually think of vivisection as an absolutely primitive way of getting any information. I really do. I think that there are many practical problems with the use of animals and in science. I think it's a very, very primitive way of getting information. But you know what? Never going to win that fight. So I'm happy to acknowledge or to accept for argument purposes, not acknowledge, but to accept for argument purposes that there have been some instances of animal use where the use of animals has been necessary to get some benefit for human beings. And the answer, you know, my response to that is, so what? I mean, what if that's the case? Is that an all right thing to do? I mean, the interesting question is the moral question. Do we have a moral right to do it? What gives us the right to say, well, it's all right? We would be much better off, for example, if we use humans in experiments. I mean, we would get actually interesting, useful data if we use humans in experiments. But nobody, well, I would like to think that nobody does. There are probably some people out there who think it's, you know, I mean, most people that we would want to have dinner with, for example, would think it's a really bad idea to use humans in experimentation, even though we would get terrific data out of those experiments and probably very useful data. But we don't do it because it's morally wrong. So what I don't understand is why do we think it's okay to use non-human animals? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that, you know, in every argument I've ever heard, basically comes down to they're animals and we're human. It's really interesting because most research people, most scientists who defend the use of animals in experiments come up with arguments that are largely sort of traditionally theological. They're sorts of, you know, well, you know, we're human and they're not. And when you try to unpack that, it gets really close to, well, you know, we're superior beings because we're made in God's image sort of thing, is an interesting view coming out of people who do research. But, you know, there's another aspect of this which I sort of find interesting. If you look at the history of the animal movement in the 19th century and the 20th century, both in Britain and the United States, what you see is, you know, you see a really focus on vivisection. Now, you know, vivisection's horrible. I don't support it. I don't believe in killing one rat to find a cure for cancer. I mean, I just don't support it at all. In the same way that I would not support killing one human being to find a cure for cancer. I just don't believe in that sort of way of thinking or those sorts of trade-offs. I think they are ill-gotten gains. If there are any gains at all, they're ill-gotten gains, and we should not be pursuing them. But you know, the number of animals that we use for vivisection is relatively small relative to the number of animals that we eat and use for, you know, for basically for food, for clothing, and things of that nature. I mean, that's an astronomical number. Now, what I find interesting is the use of animals for food is a transparently frivolous use. I mean, we've got no good reason to justify our eating meat, milk, eggs, you know, cheese, whatever. We've got no good reason. That is really no better than Michael Vick saying, "I fight dogs because I enjoy it." And the only use of animals that humans make that is not transparently frivolous is the use of animals in science. Now, again, I want to emphasize, I absolutely, positively reject it. I think it's absolutely immoral. I also think that, as I started off the segment by saying that I don't really think that it's scientifically valid, but, you know, I don't want to get into that because that's a discussion that, you know, I'll never win because of the, you know, we can spend centuries talking about whether this discovery or that discovery, you know, really would have occurred without animals. But the bottom line is, if people are willing to inflict suffering and death on, you know, quadrillions of animals every year because they taste good, which is like a really dumb, transparently frivolous reason, then why does anybody think that there's going to be massive public opposition to vivisection? I mean, the bottom line is if you are willing to support and participate in the suffering and death of non-human animals because you think they taste good, even though they are clogging your arteries and causing all sorts of health problems for you, then to ask such a person who is willing to support animal use for that frivolous and indeed dangerous purpose, dangerous to himself or herself in terms of human health, to ask that person, was it okay to kill animals to find a cure for the illnesses that you've gotten by eating animals? It's a sort of a bizarre. It's actually bizarre. And my thinking on this, although I'm not a historian, but my thinking is that one of the reasons why the animal issue has focused on vivisection in the 19th and 20th centuries, both in Britain and in the United States, is because so few people use animals in research. And it's such an abstract use for most people. Everybody can sort of get together and sort of really feel outrage about the vivisectors, and then when they break up, they can go home and eat steaks and, you know, and feel good about themselves. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I mean, I work in a university. I know people who do vivisection. Most people who don't live in a university situation probably never meet a vivisector in their entire lives. So you know, it's a very abstract sort of thing, vivisection. It's done by, you know, this group of unknown, faceless people, and you know, whatever, blah 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 blah. But it becomes a very sort of abstract sort of thing that doesn't really have any, you know, protesting. It doesn't really have any impact on your personal life. I mean, I meet people all the time who say, oh, well, you know, you're that animal rights guy. Well, I'm in favor of animal rights. I'm opposed to vivisection. And I always follow up with, are you a vegan? And they say, well, no, but I'm opposed to vivisection. I say, well, great. Do you do vivisection? Well, no. Well, then what the hell difference does it make? I mean, what does it mean you're opposed to vivisection? What does that mean? You know, what does that mean, that you express your opposition when you go to cocktail parties? I mean, what does that mean? How does that translate into your life, your moral behavior, your commitment to not treating animals as commodities, your rejection of the notion that animals are things? How does it translate? And the answer is, it doesn't. So, yeah, I've met lots of people in my life who are opposed to vivisection, and large numbers of them are vegans. And frankly, I don't mean to sound disrespectful, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I can't take anybody seriously who says, you know, I'm opposed to vivisection, but I'm not a vegan. I mean, come on.
Right, right. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. We're speaking to Professor Gary Francione, and after the break, we're going to get his feelings about companion animals. So don't go away. You're listening to Animals Today. Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Professor Gary Francione. Gary, let's talk about dogs and cats and other companion animals. And I presume you advocate adoption rather than buying or breeding. And I'll just ask you another question in addition to what I just asked you so you can answer in the way you want. There are many more adopters of dogs and cats who eat meat, hunt for sport, and support live animal shows like circuses than there are vegan dog and cat guardians. What, if anything, would you want to say to them? And shouldn't they be congratulated for saving lives and adopting?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's great for everybody to adopt. I think that's really very important. And yes, I advocate adopting. If you can't adopt, foster. If you can't foster, then volunteer at a shelter, you know, being, you know, taking or looking after animals and whatnot. Do what you can. You know, we've got a very tragic situation out there, which has become exacerbated in recently because of the economic problems that we're experiencing here, where a lot of companion animals are losing their homes. The shelters are just overcrowded to unbelievable ways. And so there's a lot of animals that need homes. So get out there and adopt those animals. Now, you know, look, I've got five dogs. I mean, we live with five rescued dogs. We've had up to seven at one time, and I think we'll probably stay at five. When you have seven, Lori, what happens is they really develop a gang mentality. They know they outnumber you, and you know they control the house. But right. In any event, we're at five right now. We'll probably go to six soon, actually. But and they're obviously all rescues, and these happen to be four out of the five are kill shelters. One was from a rescue from a kill shelter. One was from a rescue group. But you know, so I think it's great to adopt animals. I don't think we should be breeding animals at all. I do not believe in the concept of responsible breeding. That is something that drives me crazy when I see animal groups saying, you know, don't buy puppy mill dogs, buy from responsible breeders. There are responsible breeders. We have no business breeding any more animals.
Agreed, completely.
Yeah, I mean, you are talking to somebody who loves living with dogs more than any human being on the planet, and if there were two dogs left and it were up to me as to whether or not they reproduce so that we could continue to have dogs as pets, the answer is not on your life. You know, yeah, I mean, my dogs have a good life, but the average dog doesn't, number one. Number two, even dogs that have a good life, they're all neurotic. And why are they neurotic? Because this is a very unnatural existence for them. We control everything about their lives, and that's not a really very good thing. I mean, I try to give my dogs the best life that I can, but the bottom line is the best life is still, you know, not a life as an animal, really. It's a life as someone who lives in between worlds, and I think it's sort of sad in certain ways. However, what I find interesting is the enormous amount of affection that people have for the animals who are members of their family, and I don't really understand the what I call the moral schizophrenia. I mean, the whole way that we think in these completely delusional ways about animals that are members of our family and then animals that are our food. And I've had some very, very interesting experiences. For example, I guess it was last year, maybe it was the year before, I don't remember, where I encountered a deer that had been hit by a car, and there were people who were who had stopped for the deer, and the deer was very, very badly injured. And there was a guy who was on the ground with the deer, and he was petting the deer, and he had the deer's head in his lap. And I called the police to come to kill the deer, because this deer clearly was in very, very bad shape. And while we were waiting for the police person to come, I had a conversation with this guy, and it turned out he was a hunter. And he was very emotionally upset about this deer. But yet, several months after that, he would go into the woods and kill them.
Makes no sense.
Yeah, well, it makes no sense. I mean, look, but we see these things again and again and again, where people will you know, a deer falls into a creek, and you know, 17 people spend all day trying to save the deer, and it turns out that, you know, 9 of them are hunters or something like that, and you know, you wonder what's going on, what are people thinking? And I really find this fascinating, because I think most of us do have moral concern about animals. And you know, where that moral concern comes from, it can come from a number of different sources, and that's really not the point right now. But the thing is, I do think that most of us have moral concern about animals, but we have this very, very strange way of expressing it. I mean, I deal with rescue people all the time. These people spend 7 days a week, every single spare moment that they have, they are busy out there rescuing animals. And, you know, they spend their time, their money, they neglect their families, they end up getting divorced, their children hate them, because they're out there doing rescue work, but they eat animal products.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I find this really just puzzling beyond belief. And so, you know, I see part of what I do as educating people about trying to sort of get their moral feelings in line with their brains and their reasoning about the situation. Because I think that, you know, the good news is most people have moral concern about animals. You really meet very few people. There are people out there. I mean, I've met some of them in my life. But, you know, most people are not of the view that animals are just things that they don't matter morally. There are some people out there who believe that, for sure. But most people don't. Most people do have moral concern about animals. The problem is they don't really know how to think about that moral concern that they have. They've got no real clear way of thinking about it. And I mentioned Michael Vick before, and I think that Michael Vick is an excellent example. I mean, here was a guy who was engaged in dogfighting, and people weren't just angry with him. They wanted him put in jail, which he was. And people were really, I mean, there are people who still will not watch the Philadelphia Eagles play football because Michael Vick is on that team, or at least he was the last time I checked, and people won't watch him play because they're so angry with him. But they won't think about the fact that when they're watching a football game, they're sitting there eating hot dogs and hamburgers, and those products came from animals that were treated every bit as badly, if not worse, than Michael Vick's dogs. And so what I'm trying to do is sort of to educate people, and this is really largely what I do, is go around and talk to people and say, okay, if you care, what the hell does that mean? I mean, is it just a, you know, is it a meaningless statement that you make so that you sound like a nice person, or is it something you really care about? And I find most people really do care, but they can't think clearly about the issue. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. We live in a society that doesn't encourage clear thinking about anything, let alone the animal issue. So, you know, so part of what I do is say, okay, fine. If you think what Michael Vick did was wrong, how are you any different from Michael Vick? How are any of us any different if we're engaged in causing suffering and death to animals for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience? Boom, we're in the same bucket he's in. So, like, you know, before we point fingers at him, why aren't we thinking about our own conduct? And you'd be surprised, Laura. You'd be shocked, actually, at the sorts of reactions that I get from people when I do that, you know, and I sort of present it that way. And I say, okay, you know, and I use different sorts of examples of things that people find outrageous. And then I say, okay, fine. If it's so outrageous, why are you doing what you're doing? And then they look at you, and at first some of them get angry. But many of them get provoked in a positive way. And what's really interesting is I've had some experiences where I've had an exchange like that, and somebody does get angry and walks away, and then I get an email 3 months later saying, I've become a vegan. You know, you really upset me, but you got me thinking, and I really think that's really the key right now, and that's why I don't believe in wasting time on campaigns for goose liver or, you know, for, you know, getting rid of fur in Hollywood or wherever these sorts of crazy. I mean, that's why I don't waste my time with those sorts of things. I just don't. I just think they're a complete waste of time. I think they're actually counterproductive because they get people. They further confuse people. And my view is, look, there's really one thing we ought to be focused on right now, and that is getting people to sort of really examine what taking animals seriously means. If we take them seriously, if we regard them as members of the moral community, if we regard them as having some moral value, what the hell does that mean? How do we translate that into action? And my answer to that is, whatever else it requires that we do, whatever else it requires we do, it requires that we become vegan. We cannot justify, and this crazy distinction between flesh and dairy and cheese and things, and these people tell me, I'm a vegetarian. And I say, you know, so what? Would you like a medal? I mean, there is no morally coherent distinction between flesh and other animal products. Absolutely none. Absolutely none. Animals used for dairy they generally are kept alive longer than animals used for meat. They're treated every bit as badly, if not worse, than the animals used for meat.
Yeah.
And they all end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway. So, you know, this idea that, well, you know, I don't eat flesh, but I consume milk, you know, it's nonsense. And I want
to
get
make
back.
You make a good point. We got to go to a break, and you do make a good point. There are so many dog and cat people that just have a wall preventing these people to expand their thinking and actions. We try so hard here locally in Southern California to get the ASPCA, the SPCAs and the rescue groups and the animal organizations who do such good work rescuing dogs and cats, yet they have fundraising events where they roast pigs and have hot dogs and hamburgers and have horse-drawn carriages taking people around. So, good point. This is Gary Francione we're speaking to. Don't go away. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Next, we're going to get Gary's opinion about moral reasoning in animal rights, basically. So don't go away. Gary, I want to ask you now to discuss moral reasoning in animal rights. So two questions here. Should animal rights advocates be atheists, and are atheists the most effective advocates for animals?
Well, you know, let me just say that I think that I don't believe that animal advocacy should be connected with any particular religious belief system or absence of a religious belief system. The work that I've developed over the past couple of decades has been based basically on logic and rationality. I make logical, rational arguments about why we ought to include all sentient beings in the moral community and why inclusion in the moral community means abolishing and not regulating animal exploitation. Now, let me say this. I believe in making those logical, rational arguments to people will only make sense to them if they start off from a position where they care about at least some animals. Mm-hmm. So if you start off with, you know, I mean, to use the Michael Vick example again, it's an interesting teaching example. You say to somebody, right, well, if you think what Michael Vick did was wrong, if you think that dogs are included in the moral community, do you believe that? Yes, I do. Okay, fine. Let me explain to you why then you really ought to be including all sentient beings in the moral community, and why what that means is you shouldn't be killing any animals, particularly when you have no reason that is better than your pleasure, amusement, or convenience. But right, you've got to start off with somebody who cares about animals as a moral matter. And I think that that's a really very, that, you know, that's an important issue. Now, why people care about animals? They can care about animals for any one of a number of reasons, because when they were children, they grew up with animals and they learned to love them and to think of animals. You know, they learned to feel. They learned to have that moral concern for animals. Or they grew up, you know, I know people who are vegans today and animal advocates who started off being, you know, working on a family animal farm where animals were slaughtered and killed and treated as commodities, but they related to those animals, they became morally involved with those animals, and then they became open to the abolitionist arguments. But why people have moral concern, whether it's because they had a dog growing up or because they read, you know, Byron's, you know, ode to his dog, or because they have religious views or because they have spiritual views that are not necessarily theistic, they're Buddhists and they believe in the interconnectedness of life. My view is people can have moral concern about animals for a variety of different reasons, you know, because they're Christian, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Jains, whatever they are. They can have, or atheists, they can have moral concern for animals. So I think it's a very, very bad idea to try to link the animal rights position with any particular belief system, or, you know, including atheism. So my view is, look, I don't really care, Lori, why you care about animals. If you care about animals, I can get you, I can move you along towards veganism, and towards a different way of looking at animals and the different way of looking at who occupies the moral community. If you don't care about animals, then I move on to the next person. There's really nothing I
can
do.
Okay, so Gary, let me interrupt you there then. You said you don't want to link it to any particular group. How about what sometimes bothers me is the environmentalists. I mean, don't you think it's important that the environmentalists stop using and consuming animals?
Oh, absolutely. But you see, the environmentalists are sort of a curious group of people. I mean, there is nothing on the planet that is more harmful for for animal that is more harmful than animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is an ecological disaster. So the fact that you've got environmentalists or people who say, "Oh, I'm into ecology," and then you find out they're not vegans. Again, that sort of makes me scratch my head. I mean, what the hell is that about? How can you claim to be an ecologist or to have environmental concerns, but yet participate in something that is as incredibly destructive to the planet as animal agriculture, participating in it all? So, I think most of us accept the proposition that it's wrong to inflict suffering without having a good reason. And most of us would accept that the good reason has to exclude pleasure, amusement, or convenience. I think most people, Lori, agree with that you need a justification to impose suffering on a sentient being, and pleasure is not a good enough reason. If you accept that, and I don't care why you accept it, I don't care what views you have that lead you to that conclusion, I don't care. If you accept that, and most people do, then my view is that commits you to veganism. Because you can't continue participating in an institution which results in the suffering and death of what, 100 billion animals a year, when the best justification is they taste good. You simply can't do that. And I think that's where we ought to, that's where we ought to be. I think that most people accept that as a moral principle. You could say that we're all sort of moral realists when it comes to that one principle. For whatever reason we are, I don't care. Then you agree with that proposition, I can get you moved along significantly to a vegan position. And I want to say something to because I feel very close to a lot of folks out there who do the rescue. And I want to go back to what we talked about in the last segment to finish off, and that is I don't want people thinking that I am in any way denigrating the wonderful efforts of people who do rescue and who devote their lives in every single moment of their spare time and sometimes cutting into, they're not spare time. I respect those efforts. But what I need those people to think about is the idea that the animals you save are no different from the ones that you eat. And that if we're ever going to change this horrible mess in which animals find themselves, we're going to need people who think clearly about these issues. And clarity requires that we understand that all animal exploitation is not, it can't be justified. We can't justify any of it. And so I think that we really need to sort of rethink these issues. We need to shift the paradigm. But the paradigm is never going to get shifted as long as the people who are the, quote, animal people are unclear about things. So as long as you've got people running around out there saying, oh, the solution to the problem is, go to this expensive place and buy happy meat. Or, adopt a dog and come to our fundraiser where we'll kill pigs and cows and serve you steak and chicken so that we can get your money to help save animals. I mean, as long as we're engaged in this incredible morass of confusion, we're never really going to shift the paradigm.
Professor Gary Francione, we got to go. That's outstanding ending. The website is abolitionistapproach.com. This is Professor Gary Francione from Rutgers University. Thank you so much. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.